Hi, my name is Esther. I'm an old friend of Daniel McGowan's. Beginning in the early 90s, the Earth and Animal Liberation Fronts caused millions of dollars worth of damage to corporate, private, and government property in the name of environmental defense and animal liberation. It's important to note that their mission was to defend all life and that no humans or animals were ever harmed in any of their actions. Although the ALF-ELF set countless animals free and claimed hundreds of acts of sabotage against environmentally destructive entities, a few high-profile arsons garnered the most attention. The state portrayed them as eco-terrorists, sympathetic journalists painted them as tragically disaffected environmentalists, while some of us revered them as shadowy eco-superheroes. The need to remain completely anonymous left their messages to be interpreted through their actions, communiques, and the works of the ELF press office. A tragic aspect of this story is that the message of the Earth and Animal Liberation Fronts, projected through the distorted lens of the mainstream media, was largely misunderstood or completely missing from the dominant discourse. The more interesting aspects of the Liberation Front's thinking have been overlooked in the blazing glow of spectacular crimes. It's been hard to see through all of the smoke. Tonight, we are lucky enough to hear from someone who is directly involved and can now finally have a voice of his own about his actions. So, I was friends with Daniel during his involvement in the ELF, but I didn't know it. During that time, we were both vocal with strong and deeply considered evolving opinions. We wrote zines, talked on the radio, and went to demonstrations. We were communicators with a need to discuss our ideas and challenge each other's beliefs. Daniel and I would stay up all night talking around an open fire, strategizing about how to protect biodiversity, end patriarchy, or challenge nationalism. This intellectual openness and the need for public communication was incongruent with the life of an underground revolutionary, yet in many ways, it was the logical extension of many of our shared critiques. In the impatience of our youth, we considered direct action property destruction the most moral course of action. Because it was illegal, we could not talk about his decision to participate in the ELF, nor mine to not. I got involved in the direct action environmental movement because at the time, I couldn't see meaningful change or honest dialogue coming from anywhere else. In my eyes, climate change was clearly a real threat to the future health and well-being of humanity. However, the evidence and cause of global warming was actively denied in the dominant media, and between 2002 and 2010, anonymous billionaires gave $120 million to organizations working to discredit theories and research on global warming. The climate's tipping point loomed menacingly somewhere in the unknowable future, an event horizon for our planet that would affect millions of humans across the globe, billions of humans, as well as countless plant and animal species. It was as if the fate of the world hung in the balance, and drastic measures seemed reasonable. That, and we were in our 20s, so. But I asked myself, if laws are written to uphold the cultural values and norms of society, what do you do when these norms and values compromise the well-being of us all, our families, communities, and millions of threatened and endangered species across the planet? If necessary change cannot happen within legal bounds, then am I justified in breaking the law? I learned later that Daniel came to a more firm conclusion on this than I. This was a somewhat surprising revelation, not just because Daniel maintained a well-considered open dialogue about the social and environmental issues of the day, but also because he was a complete loudmouth from New York who discussed these ideas at parties, meetings, and demos, yelling about the very issues that the shadowy, secretive ELF addressed. I've learned a lot from my friendship with Daniel, specifically about integrity and loyalty. When faced with a prison sentence of life plus 135 years, he did not, like many others in his shoes, sell out his comrades or his community. Daniel has maintained a principled course throughout his trial, prison sentence, and here today. He walks his talk, his loudmouth, well-researched, and contentious talk. So thank you all for coming out today. Let's give a hand for Daniel McGowan.
Wow. It's It's hard to follow that, Esther. Jesus. I saw that introduction before, but it's amazing to get it in real life. Thank you all for coming. We packed the room. Thank you for coming out. It's really amazing to be back here. And I want to thank everyone that took time out of their life to come see me rant about stuff. I see a lot of familiar faces out there, which is really great, and even more so some not familiar faces, which is even better. I want to thank the people that put on this event, the RAD Education Group and the Student Animal Liberation Coalition here at PSU, as well as Amanda and Justin for putting it all together. And I also want to thank Portland ABC and Oregon Jericho, who are in the back of the room with an excellent info table with information about prisoners and prisoner struggles. And thank you also, KBOO, for coming in and recording this. Appreciate that. So I've been here for a few days, but this is my first time back in Oregon since June 5th, 2017. I had this strange experience, unlike most federal defendants, of going to my own sentencing, not being taken into custody, and then going to my co-defendant sentencing the next day, which was, crazy. One day I'm in a suit getting admonished by the judge. The next day I'm there in, jeans looking pissed off that I have to go to prison, watching my co-defendant Jonathan get sentenced. I'm referring to Jonathan Paul. I don't know if people know who he is. He's a lifelong activist from originally from the East Coast, but he lives in Southern Oregon. And he's I think he's been here. He spoke at Resistance Ecology a few times. If you have the opportunity to see him speak, I definitely recommend it. He's a great person. So like I said, it is really good to be back. I've spent some time in Portland throughout the years. Oregon's obviously a very loaded place for me. It's a place I lived for a few very active years of my life, and ultimately where I was indicted, convicted, and sentenced. And as a friend mentioned to me recently, I kind of spaced out. She was like, "You're going back to PSU?" And I was like, "Going back?" And she reminded me of the fact that I was arrested here in 2000 at N Corporate Dominance. I was accused of graffiti in a cop car, and I went to trial with represented by Lauren Regan here from the CLDC. And we put a good effort in, but we lost, and I got community service, which I did at some, Eugene-based forest defense group. And just, you know how it is, the community service, you just kind of people write off, you did it all, and you do some of it. And, in my case, we used a bunch of the information we got for other purposes. But So it's been a long time, and anyone that's done time in prison will kind of tell you that time is kind of a really strange thing. Like, you go away and you think everything's going to be different when you get out. And so my sense of timing, I was talking to my friend and I was like, "How long have you guys been together?" And I'm thinking in my head it's 4 years, and she's 10, and I'm like, it's just it's crazy. And so the thing about time is that I notice is how the activist life cycle and political movements have a very short timeline, and they spin, and after a while you start to see the same cycles happen and over and over. And you want to think that that's good, because I'm learning, but then you watch people coming into the movement and making the same exact mistakes, saying the same exact things that you said, thinking that they came up with the idea of resistance, as I did when I was an insufferable new activist that just really, I just knew everything and blah, blah, blah. So people in this room can definitely attest to that. So I will say, though, that it's dawned on me that because this activist life cycle is so short, there used to come a time where every single person I met had, they'd have some knowledge of my case. And so in the last year, it's kind of been interesting to see, especially in the wave of Trump, all these people come in and people be like, "Man, I kind of, I know your name, I just don't." And it's interesting. And I said to myself, it makes sense to, instead of launching into some, analysis, to lay a little bit of a groundwork, for what happened, to give people some perspective, to not assume that people, just because something's important in your life doesn't mean that people really know anything about it, right? Especially considering my point about the activist life cycle. And we're really bad, the left or whatever you want to consider it, at institutional knowledge and passing it on. And so we do have that reinvention of the wheel thing. So I'm sorry if you've heard some of this before, but I do think it makes sense to kind of just give a little bit of a background on it. So I lived in Oregon for roughly 2 years, and while I did, I participated in a number of actions with the Earth Liberation Front, and our group was rather large, 10 or more people. My focus, my personal focus at the time, was stopping old growth logging and working to stop the introduction of genetically modified organisms into the environment. There was, you know, a lot of activism. This was like, we're talking like late 90s, early 2000s. There was definitely a lot of activism on those topics. But I felt like there needed to be a more radical component to it. And the way I looked at it was like, I'm young. I don't have a lot of, you know, I don't, my like lifestyle was such that I felt like I could throw myself into things without a lot of caution. I went through a period of time where I was arrested many times for activism. I did civil disobedience, and I locked my arms into barrels, and like I climbed trees, and like, you know, I did a lot of different things in a very short period of time, and I kind of like burnt through a lot of the different tactics that our movements use, including some of the more mainstream ones like writing letters and lobbying and things like that back in New York. I thought at this point, a few years into my activism career, made a lot more sense to maybe avoid arrest. I had racked up like 12 arrests. I'd been in and out of court for all kinds of like protest stuff. And frankly, it was a bit of a drag. And I didn't, you know, I was using sort of a antiquated view, you know, like an antiquated strategy of, oh, we're going to get arrested and we're going to stop things by getting arrested. And obviously, when you examine that belief, you know, 10 people getting arrested at a protest, I don't know what that actually might, you know, it's not going to slow down the system, but there is that thought process that you're going to like gum up the works or something. And, you know, that idea died. So I moved out here and I decided to, you know, I was like, you know, I'm done with getting arrested. I was pepper sprayed in Seattle and tear gas. And I was like, I'm done with it. You know, I'm really, you know, I became very impatient, you know, frankly, which, I think people can understand, you know, as we go on in our like careers or activist life, you know, how things go. So I moved to Oregon, and I'm a city kid, and I was kind of, you know, I've done, you know, bare bones kind of hiking, but I moved out here, and I was seriously blown away by it, and blown away by just what I saw at the time as like a tepid response to it. And I, again, like, that's not exactly my perspective now, but at the time I was like, I just was stunned. I couldn't believe. And I couldn't really deal with like the destruction, and it really fueled rage in me. You know, it just contributed to it. So I spent roughly 2 years planning and researching, executing these actions on issues. We did a lot of different things. Like Esther said, the government likes to talk about the arsons only because it's the most spectacular and frankly the most dangerous, but you know, sensational and whatnot. We worked on a lot of different issues and did a lot of different things. We spiked trees, destroyed logging equipment, pulled survey stakes, destroyed machinery belonging to all different kinds of corporations. Eventually, I pleaded guilty to two large arsons. One was at Superior Lumber in Glendale, Oregon, and one was at Jefferson Poplar Farm in Klatskanai, which is previously owned by, it was previously owned by a large timber corporation that we suspected were engaged in GMO research of trees. And at a certain point, our group cleaved over ideological issues involving tactics, involving our relationship to the larger movement, and over interpersonal behavior of some of the people in our group. And I took my relationship with these people, with my fellow comrades, very seriously, and I pledged to them that, you know, should harm come our way, that my lips are sealed and I would do everything I can to help them out. So not everyone was attached to this promise as I was, as I found out in 2005. So I'm living in New York in 2005, and I was indicted, you know, out here, and search warrants and all. They planned basically a very large arrest of 7 of us on the same day. I had been, you know, living in New York, living with the knowledge of what happened, but sharing it with no one. My partner at the time did not know, which you can imagine caused issues when I was arrested. I felt hopeful that, you know, I felt hopeful thinking it would never come up, but watching the activity after 9/11, it seemed the Department of Justice was on a path to indict people for old crimes. I saw friends of mine in Oregon with a excellent group that doesn't exist any longer called Break the Chains, doing support work for someone named Sarah Jane Olson, who was involved in the SLA 30 years ago. I saw a man named James Kilgore. He's actually released a really excellent book called Understanding Mass Incarceration a few years ago. But James Kilgore was also involved with the SLA, the Symbionese Liberation Army, a ultra-left group from the 70s. excuse me. So James Kilgore was arrested and extradited to the United States and got a sentence. It seemed at the time to me, from my perspective in New York, living there after 9/11, that there was an abundance of money and, for the first time, really rampant coordination between agencies, which was new and a little scary. I mean, in this country there are hundreds of thousands of unsolved murders, rapes, and assaults, but a 7-year-old arson or a 35-year-old bank robbery gone bad clearly was, in their opinion, worth dusting off if you have millions of dollars to pay the agents, and they suddenly have this newfound appreciation for working together to get the bad guys, which in our case, you know, was us, you know. And if you look at, like, what happened in Oregon after 9/11, the two major cases that they netted was finally solving the ELF case, which I say solve, but essentially someone just decided to talk, in which case it was all over. And then the Portland 7, which were, seven people accused of attempting to get to a training facility, I believe, in Pakistan or Afghanistan. And so these people got material aid to support terrorism, essentially for not succeeding in getting to a training camp halfway around the world. So this is Oregon's, like, you know, contribution to the war on terror. It's pretty pathetic, but, you know, I mean, not that it's not pathetic everywhere else, because everywhere else it's just entrapment cases and whatnot. So ironically, I was working at an organization that provided resources for women surviving domestic violence when I was arrested. I had been in New York for 3 years, roughly, and I participated in a bunch of collectives organizing against the Republican National Convention, war against Iraq, and I worked on local projects with the New York City anarchist community. I coordinated support for Jeffrey Lures, along with a few Oregonians, and we had a large international day of action in 2004 with about 50 or so events worldwide. This week of action got a lot of attention, essentially, because the FBI sent out an eco-terrorist alert, which actually just helped us kind of with media, which was great. The day I was arrested seemed like pretty much like no other. I went to work, I helped stuff envelopes with our annual holiday card, and I made changes to the website. It was, you know, people always are like, oh, did you notice anything that day? And I was like, I didn't notice anything. I went about my day putting stickers up, you know, as I kind of rampant sticker. It was like around, I don't even remember what the hell the stickers were. I want to say anti-war, but who the hell knows? And I got up after hearing some hubbub in, like, the reception area. I heard, you know, argument and sort of my name, and I kind of just was, you know, you kind of know at that point, like, something's up. Like, you know, I'm still sketched out on cops, and so I'm like, and so these two dudes come, and they're standing in the doorway, and, you know, like, mustaches and beefy, and I'm just like, oh, that's a bad sign. And they're like, they're like, they asked me if I'm Daniel McGowan, and I'm thinking, don't lie to these assholes, because, you know, I mean, I don't want to get busted for lying, but, like, next thing I know, I mean, they knew, and so next thing I know, I'm just, like, stretched like a contortionist, you know, getting handcuffed and told that I'm, like, their Law and Order moment was being like, you're going back to Oregon. That was, like, the... That was law enforcement burn, and I, you know, of course, like, you know, if it was on TV, I would have been like, damn, you know, like, it was kind of ridiculous. They were really sneaky. They took my keys. They drove to Manhattan, where I had just been living with my partner. They let agents in. There was my neighbor, who's like a sort of like the mayor of the block, was sort of like, what are you guys doing in there? Those are good kids, and just gave them the business. And they were like, it's a terrorism investigation, ma'am. And she's like, I know Jenny, and I know them, and her boyfriend's, you know, it was, when I heard that, I was like, God, thank God for good people. Like, just give them grief, you know. They're calling the number, what is this stuff in your refrigerator? I'm like, what is it in? They're like, yogurt. I'm like, it's probably yogurt. They're like, no, it smells dangerous. I'm like, oh, it's wallpaper paste. I'm like, why do you have that? I'm like, to put posters up. I'm like, I don't, you know, it's really surreal. I think they thought it was like some super duper like terrorism glue or something, which I don't even know what that is, but I was kept in a car parked in downtown Brooklyn, right by a place called Cabin Plaza. It's where the Eastern District of New York Federal Court is. It's a really imposing building. It's the kind of building that when they're driving you into, you're just like, man, things are bad. They kept me there, and they didn't bring me to court. They kind of just gave me the speech, you know. The U.S. attorney's in town.
you know, he's here. The door is going to be open for a brief while. You think about it, you know what happened with Jeff Lurz, you know what happened with Chris McIntosh. He was an individual who got charged with the same exact charge that I was going to get charged with, which had a mandatory 30-year sentence. It's called use of a destructive device. If you are charged with it as a non-terrorist, it has a 5-year mandatory minimum, which is bad enough. But if it's a terrorism crime, it's a 30. So they were like telling me, giving me the ring around, you know, the whole rundown of how long I would be in prison. And I had been involved in some prisoner support. It's obviously a little different to be in that seat myself, but I kind of knew, you know, like I've gone to enough know your rights trainings and legal trainings. And I got the like shut your mouth thing really. Cause I'm like, you only get one chance at this. So just shut up, you know? And they put the heat on like so high, you know, and I'm just sitting there just burning up. And I'm like, I know the crazy thing about cops is like, as soon as you can assert your right to a lawyer, but as soon as you open up your mouth, that's over, you know, and it's, you can say anything. They're talking to me about baseball and stuff. And I'm just sitting there looking out the window, thinking about like my life. I told them I was represented. I picked a lawyer's name out of the air. It happened to be someone that was representing my friend who had got him a very good outcome. So I was like, yep, that's my lawyer, NOG director. He's my lawyer. And so they called, and I spent a few days there. I was flown to Oregon with pit stops in various prisons and jails around the country. I ended up in Lane County for 2 months. My family graciously offered the houses they lived in as collateral on a bond. They released me on bond with very strict conditions. I had to live with my, you know, it was kind of weird. I mean, I was very happy to like be out of jail, but I was like, you have to live with your sister and her, your brother-in-law, who, you know, I wasn't like really close to, I guess I'll say. And I'm sure my brother-in-law didn't want to, oh, wait, you're moving in here and you're going to have an ankle bracelet on? Like, this is not, it wasn't a tenable situation, but it was better than Lane County, obviously, you know, can eat when I wanted. It wasn't cold. I didn't have to wear a, you know, I was, my co-defendant actually, sadly, took his own life when he was in county jail. And when that happened, all of us were taking and put in the hole and put on, like, I was actually put on suicide watch for 10 days because of my behavior of my co-defendant. So suicide watch is its own special thing. You know, you wear something that doesn't actually fit your body. I mean, it basically doesn't even cover your privates. So you're trying to like sleep with this smock on. It's the worst thing in the world. So I was like, you know what? I'll make do with my brother-in-law. I think I can get by. So I bonded out. I went home to New York City, threw myself into my legal defense. I annoyed the living crap out of my lawyers with phone calls all day long. I got my discovery sent to me. I'd be like, don't send me paper, send me the disc. You know, they were like, oh, we've had it with you and your phone calls. I had like notes on everyone. This is what we got to do. I, you know, at the time was foolishly thinking we were going to go to trial because I was like, you know, I watched TV shows about crime and I was, you know, I'm like an activist. I think I know something about the system. And I'm like, my lawyers are like, you know, going to trial with what these people are saying about you is like, you know, life plus a couple hundred years. And, you know, that obviously was an eye-opener. So we filed a lot of motions. We filed one on NSA surveillance. There was a lot of back and forth. You know, they had to approve all their decisions with Washington, D.C. So it was kind of like we were dealing with like a proxy because, you know, the Bush White House and Alberto Gonzalez and them, their office were really the ones that were involved in like all the big terrorism cases, which apparently ours was supposed to be a big terrorism case. I basically agreed to plead guilty to the conspiracy and the arson counts on the provision that they dropped the really serious 30-year mandatory. At the point, I had roughly 9 people willing to cooperate and testify against me, people that sat in a room and talked to the government for hours about myself and everyone else in the case, like everything, our likes, our dislikes, who, what we're like. I mean, just all kinds of stuff that's like really beyond the pale, beyond like our criminal conduct, but really who we are and like everything about us, which was obviously heartbreaking. It wasn't just the main informant at that point. It was like well-spoken, credible individuals who knew everything about me and knew, you know, some of my co-defendants, we had committed like, you know, 15 different actions together. So I kind of knew that, you know, if I lost, if I went to trial with these 30-year mandatory charges, I would be like severely playing Russian roulette and that I could be found guilty. The jury wouldn't even know that they would be, you know, convicting me of a charge that could give me life plus. And so I just decided that it made more sense for me to plead out. I was allowed to go to sentence in asking for 5 years, and they were allowed to ask for 9, and I guess the judge split the baby, and I got 7, which, you know, is 84 months. They found me guilty of the federal crime of terrorism enhancement, despite the fact that the incidents I was involved with didn't involve the government. It actually involved private corporations. And in fact, some of my co-defendants were found guilty of targeting the government in the form of the Bureau of Land Management, but they didn't get the terrorism enhancement, which is an interest in verbal kind of gymnastics there, but on the part of my judge. But I don't want to sound too narrow. My case, you know, this Green Scare case, Operation Backfire, as it was called by the federal government, which is hilarious if you know what a backfire is. You know, a small fire set to pull energy from the larger fire, kind of. Yeah. I was actually, like, when I was arrested, they did this, like, real James Bond shit where they, like, took their briefing book, which is like this. I mean, I don't know if all the pages have anything on it. It could just be blank, but it's huge. And it had a photo of me, which, like, I was really good about, like, making sure people didn't take my photo when I lived in Oregon. I was like that sketchy dude that was like, no, you know, and this is, I mean, I'm dating myself, but not everyone had cell phones at the time. So it was a little easier to, like, prevent. Like, someone would come up with some flash camera and you'd be like, no, I'm not really cool having my picture taken. But apparently they did find a photo in someone, like a shoebox in someone's house. And that's on. It's Operation Backfire. And they leave me with the book. You know, it's just out of reach. I'm, like, trying desperately to get it just to see, you know. And, like, I'm sure they're watching, you know. Like, and it's Operation Backfire. And I'm just thinking, wow, these people watch too much, like, Law and Order, you know. But, you know, we coined the term Green Scare, and I don't mean to use that term because it's really not analogous to the Red Scare. I mean, what happened to people in the Red Scare is, like, no joke. No one was deported in the Green Scare. So it was never, like, a direct analogy, but it was sort of like this idea that we're in this community, we're doing this environmental activism, and people around us are like, you know, I mean, the Liberation Collective lost their 501c3 after being busted for, like, I don't know, they were accused of, I guess it's a neutrality thing, you're not allowed to be politically active, or maybe they were accused of supporting criminal activity, but that was something. People getting, like, audited, grand juries, investigations, legislation specifically about that. Wise use groups like Ron Arnold and the Center for Consumer Freedom and the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise, like these people whose jobs, or there was one called Stop Eco Violence. This woman named Kelly Stoner, who was just a timber industry lobbyist. I mean, it was just like this semi-organized effort to basically create this narrative that environmental activists are the number one domestic terror threat. And this, you know, when I say that, I can't get over it. But it's the words of Robert Mueller. It's the former FBI director got up there and said this. And when I was at Lane County and we got reindicted, because the feds like to do is they like to use the media really well. You get indicted, but then as soon as the rats in your case tell them more, they just work that into the narrative, and then they do a superseding indictment. And that's usually an opportunity for them to get more media. So on the days that they were going to have NSA wiretap motions, or NSA wiretap hearings, the first one, this is pre-Snowden, this is like 2006 when people, you know, first leaked the information that there were wiretaps from the NSA. At the time, it was like, radicals were like, yeah, I figured as much. But that day is the day they announced our superseding indictment. And I'm in, you know, like, I don't know, I'm in like my cell at Lane County and someone's like, hey, ELF. And I'm like, you know, resigned to the fact that that's what I'm going to be called. And I'm like, I'm pleading not guilty. And, you know, which you try, but people don't care because they saw you. I saw you on the TV and you're ELF and that's that. And but I come out to the day room and I'm like, what is he saying? And it's like, of course, like transcribed on the TV. And I'm like having this moment where Alberto Gonzalez, like the attorney general, is talking about my case. And that's just like the scariest thing. I'm thinking, you know, I hate Bush. I hate you. I hate all you people. And you're talking. I mean, like, I don't want you to pay attention to my case. Like, I know you, but I don't like you knowing us. And like, that's kind of when I knew they were serious, if they were willing to actually, like, this is like small fry stuff. This is like vandalism. Like, I mean, they have names for it, right? It's vandalism, it's arson, it's eco-sabotage, it's all this stuff. To call it terrorism now seems kind of like, yeah, duh, that's what they call it. But at the time, like, the idea that environmental activists would be called terrorists was just like, it was ludicrous. Sorry, I'm just checking my time here. So one of the major arguments my lawyers used when we were challenging the terrorism enhancement was that if I received it, I would be prone to being housed at these two communication management units that the BOP quietly opened. Actually, I say two. There was just one open at the time. I remember my lawyer sent me this article, and I read about it, and it was all these like really intense communication restrictions. It was a unit opened up in death row, the former death row at Terre Haute Prison in Indiana. And there was really strict limitations on mail, communication, visits, communication with the outside world. I presumed I wouldn't be able to get anything political sent to me if I had been unlucky enough to get there. And so I knew that the terrorism enhancement would result in my prison jacket, my file, being full of, you know, highlighting and red ink and all those kind of acronyms like Security Threat Group or AOF, EOF, all that kind of stuff. So I first got designated to federal prison. This was 1 month after I was last in Oregon. And I turned myself in Brooklyn at this local jail called MDC. And they told me that like a week later that I would be going to Sandstone. And I groaned because I really don't like the heat. And so I thought, Sandstone, that sounds like the desert. But no, it's not the desert. It's actually more like Sandstone, northern Minnesota. It's like Buffalo, like lake effect snow and like, I mean, we got like 5 feet of snow one time, which was outrageous, and 1,200 miles away from my house. And there's no, when they decide that you have a certain case that could garner any kind of attention from the media, they really like to bury you in the Midwest. And that's why all the supermax prisons and like a lot of the high security prisons or political units that they run are like deep in the middle of the Midwest, because so many of the people that are in federal prison are from the coast. So I spent my whole time in the Midwest, basically, and I, you know, obviously was not very happy about that, because it's like a real strain on your family to come, and it's culturally just really different. So there's not much to say about Sandstone. It's your typical low-security prison. It was full of men who crossed imaginary border lines between the U.S. and Mexico and got 3 to 7 years for felony reentry. A whole lot of men who sold crack and got crazy sentences because of a 100-to-1 ratio on crack versus cocaine, which is like largely predicated on race, and a remarkable amount of sex offenders. I played this weird game called pickleball, which is kind of like playing ping pong and tennis. It's like bizarre. Worked out. We had weights, which was bizarre. It was a low security prison with weights. We had guitars, karaoke, you know, real country club, as they say. What was interesting was as I was being transferred out of Sandstone, which happened out of the blue, it was like in May, and I was just told to come down to the office and pack up my stuff. I actually drove past FCI Terre Haute, and I saw a bunch of men at this gate, this like iron gate. You couldn't really see them too well, but it was weird. I was like, oh, they look mostly, you know, brown men, beards. I'm like, I wonder if this is like the CMU, the so-called terrorist unit. And so we asked the bus driver, which if anyone has ever done time in the federal system in the Midwest, you should ask them about this. But the man that drives the bus in the Midwest is he has one arm, which like it's cool that he works for BOP, that he has a job, but he drives the bus. And we would be in the bus chained to our ankles, sometimes chained to a piece of the bus, like a railing. And this man had, you know, he had an old style hook. And so sometimes it's a very large van and we'd be driving in the Midwest. It's windy. And I mean, he's like losing control. Like, and I'm thinking like, I'm going to die because this man is not able to hold on to the, you know, I don't want to sound like not sensitive to it. But so I asked the one arm man, I was like, what is this? He's like, oh, that's the terrorist unit. You know, that's where the Muslims are. And I'm thinking, you know, of course my sympathy then goes right out the window. I'm like, all right, that's where the terrorists are. I'm like, okay, whatever. This has to be the CMU. Go right by the CMU, get put in the shoe for 2 weeks, and end up, you know, at Sandstone. I felt like, at the time, I wasn't too happy about it, but there was a sense like, oh, I think I dodged a bullet there. Which, yeah, my experience in prison was every time I felt like I things were going okay for a split second, they went to shit pretty fast afterwards. So a few months later, I find myself at Marion. Marion is the second place that the BOP had a supermax prison. The first place was Alcatraz, and then Marion in the 60s to the 90s. And then they opened up the supermax prison at Florence, Colorado, ADX, it's called. But I show up at Marion. There's about 17 other men there. It's the second CMU. I have a friend of mine from New York was there, Andy Stepanian from the Shaq 7 case, and a smattering of people from like different discernible groups, but mostly Muslim men. There's been some stuff written about the CMU, but there hasn't been that much. I mean, it doesn't affect that many people, and therefore it doesn't garner a lot of attention. The Inspector General of the federal government did a report on communications of so-called terrorist inmates in the BOP, and they came up with this conclusion that the people who have terrorism cases in the BOP were not watched very closely. And there was an allegation made that some of the men involved in the 1993 World Trade Center case were in touch with the Madrid bombers in 2005 in Europe. I don't actually know whether or not that's true. I know the allegation was made, and in the wake of the report, the Department of Justice does what they did what they normally do, which is they hastily just kind of threw together this cockeyed plan to open up these communication management units. Well, when they opened the one at Terre Haute, it was like criticized really badly for being, you know, it was like 90% Muslim. So they were like, you can't have a unit with, you know, with such disparity in the characteristics of people that were there. So I ended up being this like opportunistic person for them. So when they opened up the second one, you had me, you know, which like the category of like the tree hugger, the eco person. You had Andy, an animal rights activist. You had a right wing tax resistor, sovereign citizens. Which are really awesome, fun people to hang out with, by the way. They're really, they have really great views on like how to get out of prison and get rich at the same time, so, which doesn't get tedious when you have to live around them day to day, and you're actually working on like your appeal or like something fairly serious, and like you have to hear about like maritime law or, you know. I'm like, so I'm a vessel, like of the Lord? Like, I don't get it. And so there were largely Muslim men, and the men there were mostly convicted of what's called material support of terrorism, which is the government claiming that their actions were somehow supporting, you know, Al-Qaeda, which, you know, it was only Al-Qaeda at the time. Now there's people that are accused of assisting ISIS in the CMU, apparently. And then there was a whole bunch of, like, entrapment cases, which I'll talk a little bit about. They even threw in, it's so crazy. I sometimes used to think, like, who the hell is coming up with this idea? Because it was the smorgasbord of different people. And sometimes the commonalities were just hilarious. Like, you'd be like, oh, look, the old Nazis playing with the Moorish Science Temple sovereign citizen. How does that, like, make sense in there? I would look at them and go, what are they thinking about the other person? Like, it used to blow my mind. We even had a few high-profile sex offenders that would basically constantly contact their victim, like including some of these high-profile, like they're not Mormons, so that they're like the off branch of they're the fundamentalist Mormons, so they're just like a different, you know. And like this one dude had like many wives, and they were very young, and it was very creepy. And he was never allowed to use the phone because he just couldn't stop calling everyone, and the government was like freaking out about that, you know. So it was a shitty place, and when I got there, we had no idea about any of the facts about the CMU. Nothing was like transparent. We had no idea how long we would be there, how to get out. We were told different things: 18 months, and then you get a transfer, or 24 months, and it was just really confusing. I reached out to a lot of different organizations, ACLU, every prison group I can think of. Only really one was interested, which is the Center for Constitutional Rights. I say interested, but I mean like had the capacity to actually file suit. And I had a pre-existing relationship with them, and I was glad for that. But it was also kind of tragic that prisoners really have a hard time getting help from lawyers, and it's a structural problem. It's not like a problem on the part of the lawyers per se, but it's largely because of legislation that like restricted the ability of prisoners to file suits themselves, and for lawyers to actually make back any of the fucking thousands of dollars that they spend fighting these pro se cases or these pro bono cases. So it's a real problem. But I got lucky, and I had help from the Center for Constitutional Rights. And we worked together for many months. I gave them all the information about the unit, like everything I possibly could get my hands on, any kind of thing they published, demographic information, trying to like make the strongest case. I wrote an article called Exposing Little Gitmo, which was our nickname for it. I mean, some of the people in the unit knew people at Guantanamo, so it was really interesting to, you know, they'd be like, this is like Little Gitmo. I'd rather be an ADX. And I was like, I mean, people had been Apparently, the zine is on the back table, I'm being told, from Justin, which is amazing. It's very old and dated now, but... So we filed this lawsuit, and when the lawsuit was in draft, it was Aref, which is my co-plaintiff, not my co-defendant because we're suing the government, but it was Aref v. Mukasey, and we filed it as Aref v. Holder, because Eric Holder was the attorney general at that time. And now it's Aref v. Sessions, apparently, and it's 7 years old. We filed it on April 1st, 2010. The BOP definitely listened to our phone calls and our visits because they essentially tried to transfer people out of the unit the day before the lawsuit was filed, and they like came in on the morning the lawsuit was filed and posted these proposed regulations, which was part of our lawsuit. We were like essentially saying, you just opened up this unit without doing any of the due process, without doing any of the like fact finding or public comment that you're supposed to do when you open up a brand new communication management unit. You just can't do it. You have to like have this veneer of like democracy, and it's all fraudulent because when they put these things out in their rules, they always get passed anyway, but it has the veneer of like legality. It didn't work. The suit is still live. Like I said, a few months ago, we got a victory from the appellate court. It reinstated the lawsuit, sent it back to the judge. But I spent 26 months in the Marion CMU. I was released to general population. And I lasted there 4 months until they found a reason to send me back. And they sent me back to the Terre Haute CMU, and when I got there, I got a chance to see all the dudes that I knew that had been transferred from one to the other, because that's what the government did. They just switched co-defendants. Someone got in a fist fight, you know, thinking this might get me out of here. It just got them sent to the other CMU. So I walked in and I got razzed by a bunch of people who were like, I can't believe you're back. And I was like, what am I gonna do? And so I spent the remaining 21 months at the other CMU, and to be honest, I met a lot of really interesting people there. A lot of people who were guilty just of being Muslim and having opinions that were critical of the United States government, or having pissed off like the Israeli government. Talk about people like whose names you might not really know: Adam Hassoun, Kifa Jayusi, Yasin Aref, Ali Chandia, Hamid Hayat, Khalid Awan, Shukri Abu Baker, and the other Holy Land Foundation people. I learned a lot from these people, including how to handle a really bad situation while being or attempting to be kind and caring, which, to be honest, is one of the first things to be jettisoned when you're trying to survive. Like, there were times where on visits, people were like, you're not laughing anymore, you're not joking. And it like kind of hit me. I was like, I'm becoming a really serious person. And I tried to, you know, kind of change that and be like, you know, I'm doing time with people that have 65-year sentences. I mean, and they are handling this, and they're coming by. They know I had a tough visit. They know things aren't going well, and they're coming by offering me, like, homemade baklava or whatever. You know, I mean, guys used to cook like crazy in there and make really wonderful stuff. And I was always really enheartened by the people in the CMU. And this is during the Obama administration. I mean, I know people are like, I mean, I can't imagine anything good is going to come out of this current situation, but... You know, this CMU, this like these entrapment schemes, these different cases that you might have heard of or didn't hear of, this happened under Obama, and it's a really horrible part of that legacy, because he created the infrastructure that will without a doubt be used by Trump and the remaining future fascist presidents to do things horrible. Sorry, I'm just checking. So yeah, speaking of Trump, I want to switch track and talk a little bit about where we find ourselves right now. So like the rise of the right wing, if you want to call it that, or white supremacists, it's a really troubling trend. And I hate to say it, but I feel like it happened kind of under our noses, like during the Obama presidency and clearly before. I don't want to suggest that this is a current thing, because these people are always there. And like, I think we have a situation where, you know, we're like shocked, like how is, you know, like people treat this like it's new, and it's not new. And it's just, there's this courage on the part of white supremacists now, because they feel like they have numbers, or maybe they feel like they have their homies in the White House or whatever. You know, I had a lot of respect and appreciation for anti-racist action, ARA, the generation of punks that came before me that fought Nazis in the 80s and 90s. I remember hearing lots of stories. I know people from Lower East Side talking about like the fights that engaged there. And I mean, I'm talking about literal fights, and I'm talking about other kinds of fights. I mean, there's just a bad history, big history of that. And it's interesting. I never contributed much to this aspect of our movement. I think I, like some people, like I just was like decided that ARA, I mean, I kept this to myself. I was never a hater, but ARA are like guys that want to fight Nazis. Like, you know, and there was definitely like that aspect. But I think, you know, it's not that I found like the action's bad. I always supported them, but like other than calling clubs and getting like shows canceled, I just never really participated. And it's interesting. I hadn't even considered this until recently. And I, you know, I came into contact with white supremacists inside, and I never got into like horrible beef with them, but it was always like a tense situation that I had to consider at all times, like who I was around and stuff, because they knew what my politics were. They assumed, you know, I mean, it's just mostly called a communist, which is all they really understood. And they'd be like, but I'm an anarchist. Like, I don't want a communist. And it just, you know, it's just like, I'm like, I guess that's, it should be worse to you, but you're not getting what I'm saying. But it's interesting because it's like this current moment has made me kind of look at like myself and like why didn't I take this that seriously? And like it's hard. I have to be honest and be like, you know, it has to, of course, have something to do with my identity, like who I am. Like I'm a white cisgendered man. Like I'm not going to be a victim of a hate attack. I'm not going to get targeted. I'm like, there's a whole bunch of things that won't happen, and that's fine. But it wasn't personal. It wasn't real to me. I can hear stories about horrible things that happen. Read a lot of history, but like, you know, it just killed me that it took like a Trump presidency for me to like take this seriously. And so I don't think it's just me, and I don't leave this as an indictment. I think this is a large part of the left. You know, I remember, I mean, these folks didn't come out of nowhere, and I'm sure there's people in this room that have dealt with this issue for many years. Despite the fact that the Nazis at some point decided that they wanted to kind of like a whole lot of them decided they wanted to be quiet. They wanted to maybe get rid of the stupid uniforms, maybe not put the swastikas up as much. There's no secret that they exist. They exist where I grew up in New York. They exist, you know, in Oregon. Obviously, Oregon's history is wrought with it. I mean, we're in Portland. I'm sure people know about the horrible killing of Mulugeta Sarah in the 90s by white supremacists. If you don't know about that, 100 Little Hitlers is a really excellent book to read about that particular incident. So, and I, you know, I was in Eugene, and like we, you know, there were skinheads in Eugene in the 90s and 2000s, and maybe now. But I was in prison when this case happened in the Midwest, and it really made me think twice about this. It was called the Tinley Park 5 case. And what this was a large group, probably 20 anti-fascists, broke up a meeting that was called like a white cultural gathering. It was essentially promoted by a bunch of Hammerskins, a pretty violent group of skinheads, if you don't know. And they broke up this meeting. And by broke up, I mean they stormed in, beat the hell out of people, destroyed everything, and ran out. And it was really interesting to me, like, the people that I knew in prison kind of like that I would talk to about different things were like, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that's what you do, right? Like, and some of these were people that just were politically conscious, but others were just like, well, what else are you going to do? Are you going to talk to them about like, you know, why they're horrible? I mean, they're talking about genocide and stuff. And it was interesting. And I came out and I actually helped with a lot of their fundraising for their release funds. And it was interesting because in 2013, when they got out like one after another, I don't think I've ever dealt with a situation that was harder to fundraise for. Like nobody claimed them. The left was not with them. I mean, I got into arguments with people who are really radical lawyers and otherwise that were like, yeah, I'm not really into that. That's adventuristic or that's this. And I'm like, You think because they call it a cultural gathering that like, I mean, two of the people at that meeting actually ended up doing time because they were like, you know, it was like one person had pornography or like child porn, and the other person was like a felony in possession of a firearm. But they were like known skinheads, known violent dudes. I mean, they can call it cultural gathering all they want, but the reality. And so I was really disappointed. I was like trying to fundraise for dudes coming home. You know, they were in Illinois State Prison having a hard time because that place is rampant with white supremacists. And it really shocked me at the time. And it started making me think of, like, you know, how important that work was. But if we fast forward to where we are right now, we have this horrible fascist in the White House. And then Steve Bannon's lackey, also Trump. Immigrants are – the interesting thing is immigrants are – and people that are perceived as non-American by these boneheads are being attacked really on all levels. I mean, the governmental level, from, you know, specific incidents, travel bans in New York, which they like to call a sanctuary city, which I would just say, let's just retire that term, because that doesn't mean anything. There's no kind of sanctuary where people get, in New York City, people get arrested for jumping the turnstile, so to speak, or theft of service more than anything. And when you get arrested, like, and you go to Rikers or you don't go to Rikers, you still have to deal with the fact that these federal agents are in the courthouse. Like, I definitely know they're in Multnomah County, because I read about it online all the time on Facebook. People like ICE agents are at Multnomah County courthouse, and they're there to basically troll and just pull people. And in New York City, we also have a situation where, you know, people are getting called in for these interviews now. That's the big thing. They get you in, once they get you at 26 Federal Plaza, the ICE building, then you're just gone, you know. And other than a few like high profile activists, that's it. Like, people are just getting disappeared, like, right into the system. So that's the government aspect, which is much talked about, the travel ban, all those lawsuits. And those lawsuits are all well and good, but we're not going to win because we get good lawsuits and judges vote in favor of us or whatever, you know, for like, you know, the travel bans being smacked around by different federal judges. But that's a temporary thing. In New York, we have these morons calling themselves Proud Boys. They're basically just like gussied up men's rights activists with like hints of like Islamophobia, misogyny, and sort of like this fanboy thing for their leader. Their leader happens to be a former Vice magazine co-founder, a Canadian immigrant, mind you, named Gavin McInnes. And when you see them, you pretty much expect, I'm sorry, this is such a bad, when you see them, you pretty much expect their moms to be yelling at them to do their dishes. Like, they're like, they are a step up, but they are toxic. And this situation we find ourselves in has given them like chutzpah, like guts to like do stuff. And I take these people at their word. I mean, I think a lot of this like liberal backlash, this free speech defense stuff needs to be like totally destroyed. Like, take them at their word. I mean, like, do you take yourself seriously? When you say something, do you mean it? Because these people mean it, you know? I mean, it's crazy. So I follow the situation. I was on probation for 3 years and I was like on eggshells. And I very much, horrible sports analogy, I always kind of felt like when I was in prison, like coach was telling, like, I wasn't a very good sports player in like baseball. So I played really hard. I got the dirty uniform, but like, I always felt like I was benched. And like, that's how I felt like when I was in prison, I was like benched. And so even when I got out, I'm like, damn, things are going to be good. And I'm like, oh shit, I'm on probation for 3 years. So I've just been like very observing, reading as much as I can, following. So I follow everything with this Milo Yiannopoulos tour. I hope you all know what went down in Seattle with the young wobbly that got shot in the stomach by apparently Elizabeth Hokaana, which is, you know, the fascist individual reactionary. Everyone thought, I mean, I guess it was presumed that it was her husband that did it. And now it kind of sounds like, when I read this article, I'm like, oh, they're setting it up like a self-defense thing. They're setting it up that she was worried about her husband and so had to shoot the guy at point blank range in the gut. I mean, there's a million things, if you were truly worried, which is doubtful, that you could have probably done other than shooting someone in their stomach. But the truth is, they're haters. So that's not really an issue. Obviously, Berkeley gave Milo a really excellent welcome a few months ago. And I think, you know, it can't be overstated. Like, these, I understand he got knocked off his pulpit, but, and that was by the right. But it's foolish to think that we're not part of this. We're not part of this, like, chipping away. I think that, you know, I think lately, it's interesting. I have not been involved in environmental work for some time, but people will, because of my past, be like, oh, you're an environmentalist. And I'm like, I always feel like, I'm not trying to front. Like, I don't really do environmental stuff. It's not that I don't think it's important. It's just sometimes I think we don't really get to pick always what we work on. Like, things end up in our laps. I mean, I have friends that, like, are on a particular path, and I fell, and their lives went like that. I mean, timeouts on grad school and all kinds of stuff. I have, like, a support. My support crew is, like, 6 to 8 people that just devoted their, I mean, like, 8 years, 9 years. Like, when we finally disbanded, it was such, like, a pleasure for me to be like, thank you, we need to, like, this is over, right? I'm out, I'm good. But so we don't get to pick always what, you know, sometimes it literally is like, what's needed, what is needed right now, and who are you, and what is your relationship, and what could you contribute. It's interesting, I get a lot of people always like, Recently, like last month, I know a lot of people, or I know a few people that got arrested at the inauguration in D.C. And so I'm sitting home, and a bunch of these people got arrested, and they're facing like 10 years in federal prison, because when you're in D.C., you're under federal law. And so they got arrested for rioting. And the blowback has been really bad. It appears that what happened is like one of the D.C. police like gave a spreadsheet of information about the defendants to a compatriot of Richard Spencer. So this person at Radix magazine essentially just took the names and then found everyone on Twitter, found everyone on Facebook, and just started tweeting like crazy, like their pictures, and with all this kind of anti-Semitic nonsense, like, look, another Jew from New York, and like all this disgusting stuff, like phone numbers and employers and like a few of my friends. And so, you know, I was like, my friend, you know, my signal was going off the hook, like, yo, report these people. And I'm just like trying to mobilize. And I'm sitting there like reporting people, which felt weird at first. You know, I was like, is this snitching? And I was like, you know what, it's not. And so I'm reporting and blocking and calling people and like, yo, and finally, you know, we get it. You know, we get it done. And yet I got to say, it feels gross. Like, I don't really engage them much with the ideas because I don't actually think that I'm going to convince them of anything. But it feels gross, and yet I don't think that really matters because, you know, some of what we have to do might feel gross. I mean, without pushback, Milo and David Horowitz would have sat there and named, like, a bunch of undocumented, pulled, like, a real McCarthy thing. Like, we have a list here of undocumented students at UC Berkeley. And a list, if I'm reading that, then what I'm essentially saying is I'm telling, like these, like, Gamergate dudes to like go attack them. Like they're cool, they're other, and you should go get them. And so, you know, when people wring their hands, and I don't think people in this room necessarily wring their hands, but I'm sure your parents do, and I'm sure like my sister does, seeing like what happened in Berkeley, you have to like ask yourself, well, what's the consequences of doing nothing? And without the pushback, what happens? Like, you know, it's hard to like quantify our victories, but I think we need to like understand, like, without obstruction, you know, what happens? People's names get read out. People fear walking down the street or going on the subway. Little kids get told to go back home. I mean, I don't really care where anyone's born from, so I don't care if they're from here or not, but little children being told to go back to Mexico, go back here, go back there, hijabs getting ripped off people's heads. Like, that sort of stuff is, you know, it feels like finger in the dike approach. But if we're not, if we're not obstructing this, if we're not using the relative privilege that a lot of us perhaps have, then, you know, it's a disservice to marginalized communities. And I say this, you know, with a sense of being in it, like I am like deep in this process of thought. I don't have actual answers of what we're supposed to do, but I do know that we have to like be engaging on these topics. Like I'm sometimes dumbfounded by like I have all this interest in Antifa stuff and anti-fascist stuff, and it's never been an issue. But like honestly, the world we're facing right now is messed up.